From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made during the second week of December when President-elect Joe Biden revealed more of his choices for cabinet positions. These are not insignificant decisions. Cabinet members will help determine policy and the course of the country in various ways for the next 4 years. Biden's choices were signals about where he wants to take the country. One of his choices brought a wave of excitement and perhaps fresh energy. It's the selection of Deb Haaland to lead the Department of the Interior. I suspect that's a job title that sounds a little nondescript or vague, but it's a cabinet position that has a wide range of responsibility. Deb Haaland first made history as one of the first two Native American women to be elected to Congress in 2018. She's a Laguna Pueblo member from New Mexico. Now, she would be the first indigenous person to serve as a cabinet secretary. But if that selection was inspiring, many observers felt just the opposite about the selection of Tom Vilsack to once again lead the Department of Agriculture. Vilsack held the position for all 8 years of the Obama administration. Writing for Mother Jones, Tom Philpott said, "The selection of Vilsack amounted to choosing, quote, stale white bread." Philpott says that while Obama promised hope and change, he delivered very corporate-friendly policy to agriculture, favoring big farm business over workers, and even setting the stage for the plight of meatpacking workers during this pandemic. Vilsack, meanwhile, went from the USDA to a million-dollar job with Big Dairy, now going back to making policy for Big Ag, it looks like. Our guest this hour will help us understand what's at stake with these recent selections. Let me welcome them to the program now. Tom Philpott is a journalist with Mother Jones. Tom, always good to have you. Welcome back to the program. Are you there, Tom? Might be on mute. Just want to make sure we're there. There you are, Tom.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can. That's probably the line of the pandemic. You know, you're on mute, or more likely in my case, please go ahead and mute. We do that all the time. That's Tom. He's a journalist with Mother Jones. Robin Silver is with us, co-founder of the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, Arizona. Robin, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Let me try Ronalyn Pollock. Ronnie is Executive Director of the Native American Cultural Center in Rochester. Ronnie, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, Evan. Thank you for having me.
All right, so a lot to talk about, and I'm going to start with Tom. Time's a little limited for Tom, and we're going to start there on what you described as the stale white bread choice here, because I think people look at cabinet selections, Tom, and in some sense, a lot of average voters don't pay all that much attention. They're more used. They just got over the election. They might be sort of tapped out or, you know, sort of drained from this whole process. But these selections are very, very important. And I want you to take me a little bit through some of your complaints, and then we'll get more specific. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure thing. So, you know, Vilsack, as you said, was the Secretary of Agriculture for the entire 8 years of the Obama administration. And, you know, Obama came in with a lot of rhetoric about doing things like busting up the big agribusinesses that dominate the industry, that really kind of squeeze farmers and workers alike, and also of sort of rejigging agriculture to be more climate friendly. And really under Vilsack, none of that stuff happened. Vilsack was really, in the end, a kind of champion for the status quo. And so I think that, like, a lot of people coming out of this, you know, brutal four-year Trump administration and, you know, really terrible USDA under Trump was hoping for a new direction, a new vision, and we just didn't get it.
So it's not going to surprise you, but does it concern you to see Tom Vilsack go from USDA to a million-dollar job to right back to USDA here? And what's the significance of that, those kinds of moves, Tom?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think one of the significances is that, you know, if you think that it's time to challenge industries like Big Dairy, which are increasingly dominated by these giant you know, essentially milk factories where, you know, thousands of cows packed together, producing milk, producing way too much waste that can be sort of, or, you know, taken into land around it, you know, causing a huge pollution problem, methane, nitrous oxide. These are greenhouse gases that come out of this manure. You know, if you think it's time to challenge that kind of production system, Well, Tom Vilsack clearly didn't challenge it because the industry gave him a $1 million job. And if we want someone to challenge it going forward, well, you know, here's a guy totally tied into that industry. So it just, you know, really sends a very clear agribusiness as usual message.
And I'd like to read from your piece from Mother Jones, if I could here, because I think some will hear, well, you know, you can't blame the Obama administration for, you know, the meatpacking workers' plight during COVID, in which we've seen large numbers, concentrated numbers of cases, especially in the early days of the pandemic with entire plants, you know, hundreds of workers coming down with COVID, some members dying. And this is what Tom writes for Mother Jones on this quote. The Obama USDA partially set the stage for meatpacking workers' plight during the coronavirus pandemic. Back in 2012, the department floated a plan to partially privatize its inspection of the chicken industry slaughterhouses. With fewer pesky USDA inspectors on the kill line, the thinking went, those lines could speed up from an already rapid 140 birds per minute to a mind-boggling 175 birds per minute, a 25% bump. Vilsack hotly promoted the move, declaring before a House subcommittee that the plan will allow the poultry industry to continue to be profitable and allow the USDA to save some money as well. Indeed, the department boasted the speed-up would save $256 million in costs, a windfall that would have accrued mainly to four large companies: Tyson, Pilgrim's Pride, now mostly owned by JBS, Purdue, and Sanderson, who together slaughter nearly 60% of the chicken consumed in the United States, end quote. So, yeah, that's a lot. I mean, and essentially what you're saying is Tom Vilsack greased the gears to make sure these changes were pushed through here. But is it a stretch? Is it a reach to you to say, look at the workers who've gotten sick? There are roots there. You don't seem to think that's a stretch, Tom.
I don't think it's a stretch because, you know, the workers in that industry have for decades worked under lines that were steadily speeding up with the blessing of the U.S. government, with the blessing of USDA and the Department of Labor. And Vilsack could have been a force to push back on that speed up. He could have said, look, these lines are going too fast. Workers are getting repetitive motion injuries at just staggering rates. Essentially, if you work in one of those plants, you have a repetitive motion injury like carpal tunnel syndrome, which, you know, you're essentially consuming the bodies of these workers as a matter of course. And Vilsack could have pushed back against that. And instead, he pushed for yet more speed ups. And, you know, it's been shown that during the COVID crisis, the plants that did speed up had higher rates of infections, higher, you know, more of them had outbreaks. So there is a direct link. Now, at the speeds before, you know, before this policy change, those were already too fast, and we would have seen a massive problem in meatpacking plants. But Vilsack poured a little gasoline on it. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
A couple more, and I'll let you go, Tom. But I mean, I look at Joe Biden, and it's, you know, Tom Vilsack is someone he's probably known very well for many, many years. He's very comfortable with him. Biden has made it clear, and if you talk to people who know Biden well, that yes, he wants to try to push in different directions. And we'll talk in a moment about the selection of Deb Haaland. But he's also someone who likes the comfort of the experience of working on policy for years, that someone that he knows well. So this is not a surprising selection, but I do want you to illustrate for us, you know, what's the worst case here? Not to be too grim, but with a selection like this, what's the worst case scenario, Tom?
I mean, I think the worst case scenario is just business as usual. I think that, you know, we could well imagine after this COVID crisis, a situation where the USDA chief and the Department of Labor head come together and say, okay, we've got to do something for these workers. I think it would be very surprising if Vilsack were to spearhead something like that. I mean, I guess it could happen, but he just pushed so hard in the opposite direction. And I also think there's an argument that, you know, hey, this agency, the USDA, was, you know, literally under attack during the entire Trump administration. You know, that Economic Research Service, this crucial research agency within the USDA, was gutted. There's plenty of work to be done to revive the USDA, and maybe Tom Vilsack's a good manager for that since he had 8 years experience. But the thing about it is there were a couple of key places where the management didn't look all that great under him. One of them is in discrimination against black farmers. He heralded, you know, this is a historical problem at the USDA. Vilsack heralded his record, but when you look closely at it, it's very empty. It was very business as usual for black farmers. And the other one was sexual harassment in the Forest Service, which is an agency of the USDA. And when you dig into that, it doesn't look like Vilsack did very much to change a festering problem there. So I think even this idea that he's some kind of wizard manager is also very much in question. So, yeah, I mean, I would guess that, you know, the worst case scenario is business as usual, which is disastrous right now.
And lastly, when it comes to the environment and even climate change, this administration, the incoming administration, has promised to be to have a sense of urgency, to have the kind of policy and leadership that will not only sort of put us back on a course that perhaps the country was on leading up to 2016, 2017, but also maybe even more aggressive than that, as many of the top experts insist we must be. This kind of selection, does it link to environmental and climate policy to you, Tom?
Oh, very much so. Agriculture is crucial to responding to climate change, also to preparing us for climate change and mitigating it. And, you know, the ideas for ag in the administration are weaker for agriculture and climate change than in other areas like transportation. And I think that, you know, the worst case scenario there is that we get a sort of carbon trading scheme that instead of pushing farmers to change practices, rewards them for a lot of practices that they're already doing that are pretty dodgy. And that would be my biggest fear with climate change and agriculture. And unfortunately, Tom Vilsack does not, you know, as USDA secretary, does not dissuade me from that worry at all. That's sort of very much his agenda, is a kind of business as usual plus approach to climate change for agriculture that I don't think is adequate.
Well, I listening to this conversation, a listener named Bob says that this is sort of the problem with Democrats. And I wonder if, Tom, if you can, on your way out the door here, just remark on this. Bob says this is the problem with Dems. They are constantly trying to reach across the aisle when they end up with the majority briefly. And the Republicans do nothing but unapologetically smash and grab at all costs when they are in the majority. I think what Bob is really saying is, you know, sort of too much watered down policy governing and conciliation as opposed to boldness. Do you see that way generally, Tom?
I think that's perfectly stated. Like, I don't want to compare Tom Vilsack to what Sonny Perdue did to the USDA, and that I have a piece on that you can Google that came out recently. So it is a different situation, but it is this responding to the smash and grab era we just went through with more conciliation that's just not going to move the needle, I don't think.
Tom Philpott is a journalist with Mother Jones. You can find his work there, and we always appreciate your generosity with the time, Tom. Thanks for the work. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You got it. Tom Philpott there. Now I want to turn to Robin Silver and Ronnie Pollack and for maybe a different consideration. So we've talked about Tom Vilsack, but now I want to talk about Deb Haaland, who in 2018 was one of two Native American women elected to Congress. And of course, that was historic. Now she would be the first indigenous person to serve as a cabinet secretary. And the position is the Department of the Interior, which is maybe not one that a lot of us spend a whole lot of time thinking deeply about, but it has a lot of impact. And Ronalyn Pollack, the executive director of the Native American Cultural Center in Rochester. Ronnie, as a Native American woman yourself, this kind of selection means what to you?
Yeah, this is significant. And I feel like, you know, we can't really talk about anything in modern day society without talking about our history first. So for Congresswoman Haaland, I know that she had a great grandfather who went to residential school. He was removed from their nation, the Pueblo of Laguna, and was forced hundreds of miles away to the Carlisle Indian Boarding School, not too far from us here. And the school's motto really was kill the Indian and save the man. And I know her grandmother, too, was also sent to a Catholic boarding school for, again, hundreds of miles away for 5 years. So for Deb Horan to receive this disappointment is very, very significant. I found a quote of hers that I'll share. She said, this moment is profound when we consider the fact that a former Secretary of the Interior once proclaimed it his goal to, quote, analyze or exterminate us. She went on to say that I'm a living testament to the failure of that horrific ideology. So for her to, you know, obtain this prestigious position is significant for our people. And also, too, it brings such honor to our ancestors as well, and to everything that, you know, her ancestors have suffered. And maybe there's some of those intergenerational traumas that get passed down. We know they still exist today. So to see her break through these types of barriers and these types of obstacles, and first to become one of, you know, the first two congresswomen a few years ago to now receive this appointment, I mean, is so significant. I mean, she was quoted, too, in her acceptance speech as saying, I'll be fierce for all of us, for our planet, and for our protected land. So to know that we have someone in this cabinet that will be able to speak on our behalf, not only of us present here today, but also on behalf of our ancestors, it brings tears to my eyes. Like, it's like, wow, it's really happening. This is so significant. You know, her ability to potentially right so many wrongs, for her ability to protect our water and to protect our land, and perhaps even to reestablish broken treaties. I mean, that's another huge topic. But even to right some of those wrongs, knowing that we have someone in office looking out for us is very significant. I mean, amongst our people, you know, we fondly refer to, you know, certainly our elders, but also like our aunties, you know, like we would fondly refer to her as our auntie. So to know that we have one of our aunties in office as Interior Secretary, you know, looking out for us and being able to speak and fight on our behalf and be a voice for the voiceless, you know, and certainly the voiceless of our previous ancestors. And to really turn on a dime all of these horrific intentions previously, even that of the previous Interior Secretary, to now be able to, you know, carve and create a new pathway for our people is really, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, Ronnie, the Congresswoman joined other Indigenous activists during the Standing Rock protests, which, of course, if listeners have already forgotten, it was about protecting tribal sovereignty against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and it attracted thousands upon thousands of people, Indigenous and non-Indigenous, from across the country. She was there in those moments, and now, you know, perhaps going to the Department of the Interior, is it your feeling, Ronnie, that we're not going to see that kind of incursion onto tribal sovereignty, you know, that this is sort of a check against that, or are you concerned that this could be an administration's way of sort of pacifying and saying, well, hey, you know, we gave you a slot, but policy is going to kind of continue as it's been going.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, and like I started out saying, it's very hard to talk about anything in modern day without talking about our history first. And it really, I mean, your question kind of reminds me of the Two Girl Wampum. For those of you out there that may not be familiar with that, was one of the first established treaties. And really what it signified, if you look at the Two Girl Wampum, there are two purple lines, you know, amongst all of this white wampum. And one boat, you know, signifies the canoe. So the Haudenosaunee people living our way of life, our laws in our canoe is one purple line. And then the other purple line essentially was the Dutch and their ship, you know, living out their laws, their religion. And the two boats, so the Two Girl Wampum signifies that while we're able to travel alongside one another in parallel, I mean, that really signifies that we can travel down life's path, but being in peace and in harmony and we never intersect, you know, so you never see those two purple lines kind of crossing each other. But here we are, hundreds of years later, and, you know, we find that now we are intersecting. And while maybe, you know, I guess what I would refer to as traditionalist Native Americans that would say, no, we still need to honor that two-row wampum and not become involved in their government. You know, we need to stay focused on our government and governing our own people. Here we are, you know, like I said, hundreds of years later. And when you consider a modern-day society and how it intersects with the Native American and with our history and with our people, you know, if we're not protecting our lands and protecting our waters. And even if that means that, okay, well, now we have people, our own Native American people in, you know, governmental positions, then maybe that's what this modern day requires in order to see that those protections are still upheld and to see that, you know, those maybe even perhaps established treaties that are meant to protect waters and are meant to protect land continue to be upheld and respected and really honored. So I think that, you know, is kind of the perspective that, that I would come from in regards to, right, what does this mean? You know, would it be that, yeah, like you said, you know, is this something that the government would use just to kind of pacify us, you know, quote unquote? But I don't know. I really see it as maybe it's a modern day necessity that we do have our own people in these kinds of governmental positions, even though it kind of, you know, strays away from what the two-row wampum was meant to signify. But, you know, I feel such an incredible comfort and a relief knowing that I have my auntie as an interior secretary looking out, you know, for what I just mentioned, you know, for our waters, for our land, yeah, for established treaties.
Yeah. And I, as I turn to Robin Silver, let me sort of let me correct a word choice. And I think Ronnie rolled with it in the spirit that it was intended. But I don't like the choice of word pacify, because the opposite, you know, the opposite of you know, of peace, of course, would be war, and I don't think that's at all the right thing to describe a Native population that has unfortunately had war brought to them in so many ways. But I think Ronnie took it in the spirit it was intended. The question was, is this going to be a choice of a secretary who's really going to be given a lot of leeway to make policy and power? Because, you know, Robin Silver, as I look at Vox, points out as Interior Secretary, Deb Haaland would be in charge of overseeing roughly 500 million acres of surface land. That's a fifth of the land in the United States, 1.7 billion acres of land off the nation's shores. The department manages the country's national parks, endangered species habitats, several oil and gas drilling sites, including the patch of land Trump is currently auctioning off in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I mean, we're talking about a humongous responsibility if the department is sort of given the respect and policymaking it deserves here. What do you see as this selection, Robin, meaning here? How did you see this particular selection?
We are incredibly encouraged that someone of the ilk of Haaland would be chosen, but Biden is still in charge. Vilsack and Haaland will be tested immediately because there's an onslaught that's occurring. You've mentioned the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I mean, imagine what it's going to be like for this person that comes in having to make up for the likes of Sonny Perdue and Bernhardt. She's got an overwhelming task to take care of, and it starts within seconds. It's literally a race. If you look at among the first tests she'll have besides the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, there's a place called Oak Flat in the Southwest, a area of central sacred importance to the Yavapai, to the Western Apache. The Forest Service right now is rushing to try to give that land away to foreign mining companies. Vilsack will have to come in and immediately stop that. Holland will have to come in and immediately stop that. They'll be tested. Where we're encouraged is that during the hearings on Oak Flat, Holland was wearing a Save Oak Flat pin, a lapel pin. I mean, she's one of us. She cares. But we'll see if Biden allows her to do her job. We don't know yet.
Are there reasons to doubt that Biden would allow her to do her job, as you say?
Absolutely. If you look at the record of Obama and Biden before, we had huge hopes. If you look at it, if nothing else, what about voter disenfranchisement? What did Obama do to protect the voting rights? And the answer is, I'm just being rhetorical, the answer is essentially nothing. If you look at their records on the environment, look what happened to the Forest Service under Vilsack. We're still suffering from that right now, where they have a placeholder and they're purely to try to make up for his failure to take care of sexual discrimination that it is rampant in the Forest Service. Consequently, the Forest Service has done even less than nothing under Trump and Perdue. And please remember, Vilsack endorsed Perdue. It was one of the few endorsements of the Trump cabinet members from any of the Obama people. It came from Vilsack. You know, Holland's got to control Vilsack to prevent any further damage. I'm on my soapbox right now, so I'll stop. But I would like to talk about the parks, the forest,
yeah,
water, relationships with the Native Americans. Huge number of issues, all of just been getting crushed under Trump.
Well, okay, so there's a lot there, and we certainly will hit some of those points coming up here in a moment, Robin. But let me also ask you what I asked Tom Philpott from Mother Jones. When some Americans sort of see these kind of selections, you know, they may be interested in the biography, they might be interested in a little bit about the policy, but sometimes it seems sort of parochial or esoteric or not always connected to other issues. How much can you take seriously, Robin, the Biden administration saying that they will be as aggressive as we need to be on climate issues? How much will you take that seriously based on sort of how they deal with some of these issues, whether it's extraction of oil and gas on some of these lands and otherwise? How connected to climate is all of this in your mind, Robin?
Well, again, we'll know right away. Because we're in a crisis. So if they come in and they don't immediately stop this program of trying to frack, mine, destroy public lands under the guise of energy independence, I mean, they're basically trying to kill the planet instead of moving to renewables. We'll see what they do right away. We'll see if Vilsack continues this onslaught of trying to take out the last of the large fire-resistant trees under the guise of fire protection. We'll see that right away.
Can you elaborate just a little bit on that last point before I kind of pivot here? When you say fire-resistant trees here, elaborate a little bit on that, Robin.
One of the missions of the Trump administration was to extract as much as they could from public lands. So, for instance, Perdue, as the Secretary of Agriculture, would call the regional foresters to get personal reports on the timber quota, the amount of board feet they were getting out. That's an anachronism. Like that, these are days when we're trying to climate proof our forests the best we can as we're going through extensive dry periods in the West. We need to keep as many of the large fire resistant trees alive and standing, not be cutting them down. the policy prior to the Trump administration under Vilsack was to cut down these large fire-resistant trees. Under Trump, it's been on steroids, and now we'll see. Vilsack has to come in and stop that immediately. It can't just be lip service in terms of trying to protect our forests in the West against catastrophic wildfires. We need to do that by treating them wisely, and it's not wise to take out fire-resistant trees in order to protect the forest. That was the policy under Vilsack previously, and that's been the policy under Trump.
All right, that
has to change.
So you're saying, Robin, that that's an example of something we'll know within probably days of the administration taking power later this month, just how serious they are about those issues. But one other question, as we watch those wildfires out west, that's you're giving us a sense for one thing to watch for with this administration about what does or does not need to happen. What else needs to happen to try to mitigate these fires on an annual basis that we're seeing, Robin?
Well, climate change, period, is the elephant in the room. So we need to have, this is like another Manhattan Project in order to try to get us back on track. And it looks like Biden is pretty focused on that. He's got a climate czar. He's got, it's supposed to be, all the departments are supposed to be working together. We'll see. If you want to stay focused on what the individual agencies can be doing, then agriculture, he can look at a big commercial agriculture and look at their methods. They produce huge amounts of greenhouse gases just because of their methods, because they're petroleum-based. We've already mentioned the large trees. That's the Forest Service. The public lands in the West are getting devastated because during a drought, we're not reducing the numbers of cows that are grazed on public lands. So besides the fact that cows methane, we've got cows that are denuding the public lands of the grass that we need in order to not have these catastrophic wildfires, because the grass is what carries the low-grade fires. Take away the grass, the fires move through the tops of the trees, and that's when you see the images on TV where you see the forest disappearing because the canopy is on fire. That's antithetical to what our forest evolved with, and that's what we're trying to prevent with some of the restoration efforts. Vilsack will have to be on that right away. Water in the West is disappearing. So that's in that'll be under the management of both Vilsack and Howland. Under Trump, and actually on Obama prior to Trump, there was no protection of water on public lands. That has to change. And so if you look at what's at risk, you look at the Grand Canyon is threatened by a huge development. The development needs Forest Service approval. Under Trump, that's been moving ahead. Under Vilsack, that will have to stop. If you look at some of the massive developments proposed in the West, all dependent on groundwater pumping, groundwater is not sustainable. It's not renewable, particularly with climate change. That needs to be controlled. That will be spearheaded by not just Vilsack, but also by the EPA head and also by Howland, who's going to need to be an advocate for public lands. And I would say ditto with public lands are the Native American lands, the tribal lands that are also deeply affected by this excessive diversion and extraction of groundwater, because that deprives the reservations in the West of water. It's been a long problem and it needs to stop.
Well, after our only break, I want to ask Ronnie Pollack about some of this one, as I think about the woman that she affectionately described as as an ante. I love that framing of just the way that the Native community is looking at a possible cabinet secretary, the first ever an Indigenous person. That would be Deb Haaland, who is a member of the United States Congress. After our only break, I'm going to talk to Ronnie about that, but I also have some feedback from listeners for Robin Silver and Ronnie Pollack. Robin is a co-founder of the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, Arizona. Ronnie Pollack is executive director of the Native American Cultural Center in Rochester. And we'll get right back to that after this only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we have three superintendents from local school districts joining us, giving us a mid-year update on schools during the pandemic. What does it look like going into the spring? What's life been like in the orange zone for some of them? What's next? How are teachers handling this? How are they dealing with absences and more? Schools and the Pandemic, Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Ronnie Pollack, I think Robin Silver's making an important point about within days knowing just how much this administration is going to be serious about some of these issues affecting lands, affecting tribal sovereignty, affecting so many other related issues here. And Ronnie, I guess I'm hopeful that while the Congresswoman is someone who you think of as an auntie, you know, she's also a strong and accomplished person. And I suspect that if the administration is pushing back against what she sees as the right direction, we will at least know about it. Are you confident in that, Ronnie?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like, you know, she has the ability and has already shown that so far to be a voice for our people. I mean, some of the things that she's done so far, she introduced legislation that established a truth commission on Native American boarding schools. She also spearheaded two laws to combat the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, which is very, very significant to our people. So I think if there was something that was happening that was not right, I mean, you know, for a plain way to explain it, or was not happening justly, maybe that's a better way to frame it, she would be that voice. I have full confidence that she would, you know, utilize her voice, utilize her position in a respective way to be that voice, to see where these injustices are happening and to speak about it for our people. I certainly have full confidence in that. She had also said too, I believe, she was quoted as saying there, Congress has never heard a voice like mine. So again, as I affectionately refer to her as my auntie, you know, appointed to this Interior Secretary position, knowing the fierceness, you know, that she has already represented in some of the, you know, the legislation that she's introduced so far and some of the work that she has brought recognition to so far in her position as Congresswoman, I have no doubt that she will continue to fiercely advocate and fiercely be that voice for the voiceless, for the Native American people. I mean, oftentimes, you know, we refer to ourselves as the minority of the minorities because our numbers are so small in comparison to other minority groups. Oftentimes, our voice can be very faint and our voice can kind of fade away when it comes to important issues. So knowing that, you know, that we have this fierce auntie, you know, as Interior Secretary, you know, again, I have full confidence and really like feeling secure. It gives me a great sense of security knowing that, you know, she will utilize all of her characteristics and all of, you know, really the strength that's been embedded in her from our ancestors. You know, she utilizes that in her position as well too. And so that gives me a great sense of security, knowing that she'll use that fierceness, you know, on behalf of all people, certainly, you know, that's her responsibility. But, you know, also too, giving recognition to Native Americans, you know, across Turtle Island.
All right. Let me get Rich in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
Hi, Evan. How are you doing?
Good, happy New Year. Yeah, happy New Year to you, Rich.
I have questions about things like the Bears Ear National Monument and the Wildlife Refuge. Is there a way that they can rescind some of the licenses that he's trying to sell now? And I just have this feeling that he, Trump, will want as much physical change and damage done to these places to make them almost like Bears Ears is special. I've actually seen it. Do you know if they're going to try to restore it to its original size that Obama had? And will they do something to stop the licensing, selling the licenses on the North Slope of the Wildlife Refuge in Alaska?
Yeah, I don't know on that one. Robin Silver, do you?
We'll see. We're actively litigating both. We've got over 300 cases that we've filed. I personally have 18. All of these cases need to be settled because you've got an administration that is advocating for destruction and a new one coming in that says things are going to be different. We'll see. I don't know how to answer it any other way.
Go ahead, Rich.
Have they done any damage to the Bears area yet? Have they done any changes there on the National Monument out there?
I do not know. I do not know the answer to that.
Yeah. Rich, thank you. That's probably just another one, on the list that we're probably going to see pretty quickly when it comes to a shift in policy. And, Robin, I know you wanted to talk more about parks, forests, water. What else is at the top of the list that you're going to be watching for?
Well, let me just say this. Is Holland is tough. There's no doubts whether you call her Auntie, you call her, you know who she is. She came from the most difficult of personal circumstances to become a congresswoman and now a cabinet member. I mean, her story is just inspirational. The question will be is, will she be muzzled? And as I said, we'll know right away. Because these issues are all they're all being decided within the next few months at the longest. So she'll have to come right in. She'll have to do what she can in order to stop the land transfer that is Oak Flat. She'll have to come in and advocate for protecting the Grand Canyon National Park against the huge proposed development there by Italian developers. She'll have to turn her agencies that she's supervising completely around. At this point, there is no advocacy for parks. There's none for the BLM. The BLM is one of the biggest landholders in the country. That's where all the oil and gas extraction and the fracking is focused. She's going to have to come in and get a handle of that. This starts on day one. I mean, imagine what it's going to be like for her. The gun goes off, and she needs to have to be in action. But she's taking over agencies just like Vilsack that have been gutted. So, for instance, at the head of the Fish and Wildlife Service, which makes a decision to protect endangered species, which are our canaries in our mine for all the public lands, under Trump, and actually over under Obama previously, the plan was to not protect endangered species. She's going to have to turn that around. But how does she turn it around when we don't even have a Fish and Wildlife Service director that cares about endangered species? She's going to have to get help. At all the agencies that she's now taking over, there's no level or no leadership, no advocacy, even down to the regional levels. She's literally taking over an army with no soldiers. She's going to need to be tough.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. That's exactly what she told Vox, and that's what she has testified to. In an interview with Vox, Congresswoman Holland said that a bulk of her job has involved listening to testimonies from community members, many of whom, she said, have expressed concerns regarding the Trump administration's move to eradicate and redevelop cultural sites and overhaul crucial environmental policies. And she said, quote, part of what needs to happen is just make sure we are putting back all of those people, all of those scientists, all of those folks who are on the front lines, working to protect our environment immediately. Trump has gutted this department and so many of those positions, actual people. So we've heard that across departments for 4 years now. We've heard departments were not filled. We've heard departments, members were dismissed and sometimes replaced, sometimes not. So that is a big, big responsibility. But I'd like both of our guests as we wind down the program. And Robin, I'll start with you. You know, for those listeners who are happy to see a new administration come in, is it do you think it's facile or dangerous to think, well, if we just go back to how it was in 2008 to 2015, you know, sort of things are automatically or de facto better? I mean, I guess that's debatable, but I think there is a little bit of a mythologizing about those years and, versus the reality of some of what happened in the country in those years. How do you see it, Robin?
We cannot go back. We were falling behind under Obama and Biden. Vilsack was part of that. We need to be careful. Luckily, though, we now have new folks like Holland. So we'll see, but we cannot go back.
Ronnie Pollack, are you someone who felt like those 8 years under Obama and Biden saw progress with relationships with indigenous people, understanding tribal lands and rights and treaties, or do you feel like there were some missed opportunities?
Yeah, I feel like there were some missed opportunities. And much like Robin has already stated so far this past hour, I agree with that. While I, you know, affectionately referred to, you know, Congresswoman Holland as my auntie, and have no doubt of her fierceness, at the same time, too, I'm not completely unaware of the fact that, yeah, she could get in there and, you know, be slighted or, you know, have all of these things coming at her and maybe without the underlying support that she really needs. And so I think that, too, kind of even lends itself to some of what I had shared earlier with the two-row wampum, that this is some of why we had that treaty, you know, because we knew we could trust our own people and our own governing system. And, you know, how that would affect our own people. But so to get involved in another government and governing system over, you know, a much larger section of our population is different. And it comes without those securities, you know, and maybe sometimes it comes with some representation of falsehood as well, too. And I don't know. I don't want to go too far off the deep end with that. But you know, I hope that will not happen. But again, I'm not ignorant of the fact that that could be a potential as well, too. So, you know, I'm hoping, yeah, that she has all the girding that she needs. But, you know, much like Robin has explained already, you know, I mean, she's kind of going to be starting off the front line, with maybe not all of this initial support that she needs to begin with. So, but we got her back. We're, you know, we're saying prayers for her for sure.
Well, and Ronnie, maybe about another minute or so here, when you think about treaties, I mean, I am so much more aware of how poorly educated I was about treaties, about what they are supposed to signify and mean, and how often they were ignored or broken. And the sense now seems to be that if we have a Secretary of the Interior who is an indigenous person and we don't see a move to actually honor treaties now, will we ever? Does that sense of urgency come to you?
Sure, absolutely. And so I think that's what I was kind of alluding to when I was talking about like a falsehood.
Sure.
That, yeah, definitely. I mean, and I think, you know, you're not alone, Evan, in being, you know, let down about how uneducated I would say the majority of our population is in this country in regards to treaties. I mean, there have been approximately 500 established treaties between Native peoples and the U.S. government, and the U.S. government has broken every single one. And I believe the Native people, and I can't remember which one it is exactly off the top of my head, we had only broken one, and it was for a very extenuating reason. But we are people of our word and of our honor. You know, our word is our honor. So for us to break a treaty, I mean, that it's just unthinkable. And so, right, when you learn about the history and the reality of all the broken treaties, it's almost like these treaties were established almost seemingly knowing that they were meant to be broken, as far as, you know, the government's perspective is concerned. So, yeah, that really is, you know, it's not a thought that is scary. Like, right, if she's in this position as Interior Secretary and some of these treaties aren't reestablished, well, then when, if any, would be a time that they would be honored and reestablished? But I feel like, and I hope I'm not looking at this with rose-colored glasses, but I feel like the tide is turning in regards to, you know, repairing and reestablishing broken treaties. It's slowly changing. You know, the pace could be a little quicker, but at least there's some movement and there's some discussion, and even just starting out in education, people being more educated in regards to treaties and how they've been broken.
Well, I want to thank our guests for the hour. Ronnie Pollack, Executive Director of the Native American Cultural Center in Rochester. It's always an honor to have you. Thanks for the time, Ronnie.
Thank you, Evan. It's always an honor and a great pleasure. Thank you.
Great pleasure to have you and Robin Silver, co-founder of the Center for Biological Diversity. Robin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And our thanks to Tom Philpott of Mother Jones, who joined us earlier this hour. Megan Mack is not only the producer, but also the engineer this hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.